If scary movies give you dread, keep you up late night in bed, here's a podcast that will help you ease your mind. We'll explain the plot real nicely, then we'll talk about what's frightening so you never have to have a spooky time. It's Ruined.
Hey everybody, welcome to Ruined. I'm Hallie.
And I'm Allison.
This is a horror movie podcast. We ruin a horror movie just for you.
Just for you guys. Hallie, how are you?
Literally the exact same since we last spoke.
Yeah, which was not long ago.
No, I wish I had anything interesting going on. I'm trying to, let's see, nope, cataloging my, nothing. I think January I'm just doing nothing.
Yeah.
I'm watching Drag Race. I'm in a Drag Race draft.
Nice.
But I haven't watched any of it yet, so I'm losing money.
Oh.
And
you should watch it.
Well, I don't have TV. I don't have like a.
Oh, why did you join TV. This draft? If you,
I wanted to. My friends were doing it. And I wanted to talk to them about it.
Participate.
But then I'm going to start going to a gay bar because they're screening it. So there's like about where it's
fun.
Like ending my Fridays alone at a gay bar watching Drag Race. But that sounds like heaven to me right now.
Honestly, that sounds great. It feels like such a fun show to watch in public too.
Yeah. How you doing?
Oh, I'm fine. Not a lot going on
yeah,
here.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, everybody.
We don't have stuff happening. It's January. I'm eating a lot of cottage cheese. I'm on that kick.
I believe you've already spoken about cottage cheese on the podcast recently.
I'm like the ice bath for the face, the cottage. Like, those are my kind of big notes for what I'm up to. As we close out January.
Devastating. Yeah, this
we're recording
is, we gotta
a little.
Get out of the fucking house, man. This is tough.
I know. I'm trying to think if I've, like, done anything or seen anything.
All I watch is horror movies and stay home, so no, I don't.
Alyssa bought me a shirt
with pictures of Riz on it. Thank you. Finally, talk about it. Beautiful. So, incredible.
It looks like kind of like a rapper or band t-shirt. But
do you want to be buried in it, you think? You think
I absolutely want to be buried in it. That is my only request upon my death is that you put me in the Riz shirt before you put me in the ground.
I will fight your parents. I don't know why I assumed you would die before them. I apologize, but I will fight them to make that happen. I don't know why Amelia was like,
they'll probably
next 6 months.
All of us. So I don't know. Got a cool shirt. And then I put it down on the bed to take a photo of it, and he immediately jumped on it and laid on it. And I was like, do you know that's you?
No, he doesn't know anything else.
He does. I hold him up to the mirror and I scream, "That's you!" all the time.
Okay, so that's what you're doing with your time. Okay, that's more like what I was thinking was going on.
Okay, yeah, how are you filling the days? Trying to understand if my pet has any concept of reflection.
You know, if anyone's going to figure it out, it's you, I think.
Yeah, but like cats think humans are just bigger cats, so I don't know if he's like aware of...
Right.
I don't know. I mean, I can't tell if he's smart or dumb, but he is my perfect little boy.
And that's...
And you're he likes the shirt, too. It's Riz approved.
Good. I'm so glad.
So that's it. That's it. That's all I got.
Hey, everybody. It's Hallie.
And Allison.
This is an ad for our February 25th live show. It'll, of course, be at 7 p.m. Eastern, 4 p.m. Pacific, as it always is.
And you can get your tickets, as you always do, at moment.co/ruin. That's moment.co/ruined. And come and join us as Hallie ruins...
Human Centipede 3, we thought, look, it's Valentine's Day, everyone's cozied up, why not do something a little romantic?
Yes, and if you are eager to listen to the first two, we did cover them for Patreon. Human Centipede 1 and Human Centipede 2 are on the Patreon, so you can subscribe to the tier where you get the extra episodes, and if you want to, listen to those before Sunday, February 25th, when we ruin Human Centipede 3 live.
Though I'm not going to lie, you probably could piece it together. If you just had a start on 3, I think you'd be able to put the pieces parts. But either way, please join us on the 25th, and you could go get tickets at moment.co/ruined, and we'll see you there.
See you there.
This week's movie is The Empty Man. It's part of a cold month, and the movie starts cold, and then we move into sort of a rainy element.
Okay.
But at the beginning, we are... absolutely in a blizzard. And this is
terrific.
A movie that I had watched. It's actually, it is 2 hours and 16 minutes. I am on the record and I will continue to be on the record as saying that a movie, especially a horror movie, does not need to be longer than 90 minutes. They almost never have to be. Some exceptions. I think the Suspiria remake earned it. There's other movies, obviously, that are longer.
Look, I mean, there are long movies that feel short and there are short movies that feel long, but maybe we just start kind of trimming back these runtimes a little bit.
Absolutely. And this movie ended up, I think, being sort of, it came out and then it wasn't really getting, that's what it was. It was initially going to come out during, on October 2020. So there's sort of pandemic problem where the film was released. It was a $60 million budget and it grossed $4 million. But I mean, any movie when they were, you know what I mean? Like, that was just a mess for any movie. And yeah. I do have a lot of, sympathy. Written and directed by David Pryor. And a film, there's on Wikipedia, they're like, it received mostly negative reviews from critics and audience at the time. I actually ended up liking this. I will say, then later it's saying that online, it got kind of more of a cult following. And I will defend this movie.
Okay.
It is too long. And so I would say about an hour left, I thought, we have got to get this empty man out here. We have got to wrap this up with him. That being said, I did enjoy it. It is based, much like we just did 30 Days of Night, or that will come out later. Unclear. 30 Days of Night will be coming out before or after this, and which is also based on a comic book. This is also based on a comic book created by Cullen Bunn and artist Vanessa R. Del Rey in 2014. And this, to me, I think that I would love to actually read this comic book, because I think that these the elements that are brought up are expansive and complicated in a way that something like a comic book, that to me makes more sense. So like a narrative where you could sort of play with different imagery and over a larger amount of written text versus some guy named Garrett telling it to you in a whole, monologue, which I enjoyed as well.
Sure.
But and it's interesting reading this on the Wikipedia is that like in the Empty Man comic book, it's framed a little bit differently. In the description of the comic book, it says the so-called Empty Man disease causes insanity and violence. That's really interesting because it's not really, we approach it from a different angle, but it is the same concept, something that is communicable. And so the Empty Man is you and me, Allison, and it is all of our listeners. So let us get into it. We always like to have Allison watch the trailer to get her takes. What are your thoughts about the Empty Man trailer, Allison?
Even the trailer, a touch long. I did get a sense of like exactly what the plot is here, but I do love anything that kind of centers on like an urban legend of like calling someone into, your presence.
Absolutely. Sign me up. As soon as I saw that, I'm like, absolutely.
Yeah, though I can see how it gets long just by the legend where it's like, the first day this happens, the second day this, and it's like, oh, it should just like be like, you call him and he comes. Like, I don't know that we need a week's worth of kind of buildup.
But again, some of our favorite, most famous films, The Ring, we have a 7-day lead up and that they keep that moving. I'll tell you.
They do keep it moving. But yeah, scary. Also like the Empty Man, very scary phrase.
Yes. What does it mean? So, and a man, already scary.
Yeah.
And it'd be empty.
Very scary.
I would also like to take a baseline scary. And I'm trying to think of what to ask Allison that is not giving away too much.
Oh, I see.
Because there's a lot in this, but it sort of unveils over time. Mm-hmm. How scary do you find the concept of the collective unconscious?
Oh, very?
Do you believe that such a thing could exist?
No, but it's a scary concept.
Yeah.
Like, you're like, ooh, what if it did, though? Like, that's boy, if that did exist, I would not be happy.
I think it's one of those things, like, again, just on Wikipedia, but the idea of, like, Jung and, like, the idea of archetypes. The problem, ultimately, and we're seeing this, I think, in society now, is that, like, anytime you try to create an archetype or a concept, you immediately start limiting, and at least in Western society, immediately start, like, making a hierarchy out of things.
Yes.
So it's sort of like the idea of, like, archetypes of our society show up, you know, in our dreams or in our unconscious, like, ideas. That makes sense. The idea that, like, these are things that exist outside of, like, society as it exists right now that are somehow, you know, populated outside of our knowledge that I don't think is super helpful because it's very, I think it's very societally specific. And obviously it's like, there's a mother. Every society has a mother. Or like,
right, yeah. There are some things that are truly universal, but for the most part, there are real lines between like, oh, we don't care about that.
And I don't know. I think as we all look at the hierarchies that exist in society today, I think there is a lot of like science or psychology being like, mm-hmm. well, here's how things are, rather than mm-hmm. here's a story. We're trying to like use these elements to describe something, which mm-hmm. makes sense. And I think maybe that was the intent for some people. But then it's like, don't come and then tell everyone all this when in reality it's like, or that's like, you know, what one psychologist who was lived in Switzerland, you know, in the early 1900s thought about this, you know, not that we can't draw from it, but this is a lot about entering into a group and sort of like trying to decide how you feel about the group's ideas mm-hmm. and a group that is pretty clearly a cult. And mm-hmm. sort of our main character's interaction with it, which, again, we also love. That's a really excellent idea for a horror movie. And then finally, would you like to guess the twist? And there is a proper twist at the end of this bad boy, Allison. Would you like to guess the twist in The Empty Man?
Guess the twist.
I mean, I'd love to guess, but it's like I don't have a ton mm-hmm. of...
Go with what you know.
Okay. So it seems like you summon the empty man.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to guess that the people who, the group that ends up summoning him end up going with him to the other side of where, whatever the line between reality and it, like, it was like proposed as a joke, but then they're like, no, he actually just wanted to, like, we're choosing this.
Great. Know. No, I love it. That's perfect. You did a great job.
I guess. We'll see.
All right, let's begin ruining the empty man. We open on the Ura Valley in Bhutan in 1995. And we hear at the beginning sort of this low singing voice. We see four American white people, Greg, Fiona, Ruthie, and Paul, are hiking up the mountains in this valley. Gorgeous, beautiful forest.
Mm-hmm.
They wave at sort of a truck full of Buddhist monks as they drive past. They hike higher and higher, and they find a shrine with Buddhist prayer wheels. And finally, they get to a rope bridge, which
in a million years.
And this one's very sturdy and looks very well-maintained, but it's over a gigantic, terrifying ravine, Allison.
I can't. Heights are like...
Yes, I concur.
I'd rather like spend like a night in a coffin.
Oh yeah. Than, like, oh, you gotta spend walk the night across in a coffin. 100%.
A rope bridge.
My two fears: one, heights; two, and we've discussed this on the pod at some point, leaving a baby in a car, which is funny because I don't have a baby and I don't have a car.
You don't have access to a baby.
But there's something about that is so terrifying.
It is very. It's just like
because it's an undoable. It's like if I get hurt, if I fall from a height, well, it's just me. You That's leave a baby me. In a car, you walk outside, it's like, oh, no, the baby. That's insane. Everyone in this movie is braver than we are. So they cross the bridge. The bridge is fine. And we see on the screen, day one. They climb higher and higher, and it's incredible views, mountains, forest, gorgeous. And they see in the distance a storm coming in. And they said, oh, it's getting stormy. Let's climb back down. Basically, it's like they're 5 miles from the nearest town. Like they're in the middle of nowhere. Paul stops him and says, do you hear that? And it sounds almost like a humming or a ringing, like a low tone. And he attempts to sort of follow it. They're on this flat rock surface at the top of one of the mountain peaks. He walks across a rock face and he falls directly into a crevasse.
You hate a crevasse.
The other three run over to him and they're like, are you okay, buddy? Allison, it is a jet black pit into the top of a mountain. He's probably not great.
No.
But obviously they're pros. They wouldn't be doing this if they were not hikers. Sure. So Greg spelunks down into the darkness with their equipment. Paul is not at the bottom of the crevasse. Instead, at the bottom of the crevasse are a million little cave crickets crawling around, which is a disgusting but really excellent addition to this, where I'm like, oh, there's bugs now. Great.
Yeah, it's not just that you, like, fell and you're maybe injured and possibly stuck. Also bugs.
Yes. Greg sort of wanders into the adjoining cave. Allison, he sees Paul sitting cross-legged, sort of at prayer, staring at the skeleton of a gigantic humanoid creature set into the wall. Sort of a fossilized
real remains, skeleton?
A real skeleton. This person is 15, 20 feet tall.
Oh.
And we see wings attached to the back. So we see the bones of the wings.
Okay. Great.
Greg does not spend enough time freaking out about this, if you ask me.
That's all I'd be freaking out about.
But he does ask a great question. What is this? That's a great question to start with. He goes over to Paul, who looks nearly catatonic, but he whispers to Greg, if you touch it, you'll die. Greg's like, okay, well, let's get the fuck out of here
Let's not touch it then.
And he tries to help Paul up, but Paul's shuddering, crying. He's breaking down. And the girls are up top are calling for an update. So Greg has to physically carry Paul out. And the cave is so full of crickets. So you're hauling your, like, catatonic best friend out. Crickets everywhere. And you just saw the body of a demon or an angel or an alien stuck into the wall of this ancient crevasse that maybe no one's ever been in for, like, 500 years, you know? They get back up. They pass over the rope bridge again. But the storm is coming in, and Greg has to physically carry Paul, like, over his shoulders. And it's very slow going to the point where they have to take a break. And Greg says, I don't know if I could do this. We're going to have to drag him or something. I can't carry him. Fortunately, Ruthie wanders over to look over the ridge and sees a little house. And they run over to it. It's obviously a house set up for hikers. Mm-hmm. So it's like there's a stove. It's they can make a fire and be warm. But nobody lives there. It's just like for people to stop in as they go hiking, which I feel like is a thing in Europe as well. Like, I feel like a lot of places have that. America, mm-hmm. I feel like we're not allowed to have that. Our society
has a gun.
Yeah, unfortunately. Yeah, you just go in there and immediately get shot. So they go in and they take Paul inside, lay him down, and they sort of start to like check him, but there's no obvious problems. Greg says, let's get his clothes off and let's look. He says, let's look for insect bites. But I was like, I would be much more likely to assume he had a head injury for the way he's been acting.
Yeah.
Insect bites.
Like that's a good thing to be like, as we move through this, let's also keep an eye out for that. But like, it wouldn't be my first guess.
Allison, in Paul's clenched hand, they finally find what looks like a bone flute. So it's a piece of bone, sort of decorative ends, and it looks like it's made of a human bone. And Paul is just clutched in Paul's hand.
Hey.
And they sort of put that aside to deal with that later. And Greg sees that Paul has sort of, self-harm marks on his wrist. Mm-hmm. And he asks Ruthie, well, how's Paul's been doing? And Ruthie, like, takes it to an 11 in a way where it's like, okay, so Paul wasn't doing well. Like, if think you'd be able to talk about it. Or if this is from his past, it's like, well, yeah, like, he, you know, he's had depression or whatever.
Right.
But she's like, he's been fine. It's like, okay. Not helpful right now. Meanwhile, Fiona goes to get water from a stream and sees the storm is like basically about to be on top of them. So they all argue when they get back and Ruthie's panicking, sort of like, well, what if Paul hit his head? What if he's internal bleeding? We have to go to the hospital. Greg says, there is a storm. We are 5 miles still from any road and I can't carry him in a blizzard. He looks fine. He's breathing. He's let him sleep. I think we're going to be fine. Also, if he's not, there's nothing we could do about it.
Correct.
That night, Greg and Fiona go and sleep in one of the other rooms. They all have sleeping bags and stuff, so they have, like, warm stuff.
Okay.
And Ruthie is sort of holding vigil for Paul, which I get to, like, just making sure nothing happens in the night. She picks up the bone flute and sort of absentmindedly blows across it like you'd blow across the top of a bottle. And it goes, hoo.
Not great. Not a good move.
And we realize that was the sound that Greg heard on the top of the mountain that sort of drew him to the crevasse. She dozes off Allison, and when she awakens, she hears someone walking outside the cabin. She goes to check on Fiona and Greg. They're fast asleep, and then the walking seems to disappear. Mm-hmm. In the morning, it turns out they're completely snowed in. And on the screen, we see day two.
Okay.
So fortunately, because they had packed well, they have food, so they're able to cook and make a fire. So they're fine. Other than the fact that Greg has some sort of mountain madness or something,
yeah,
they're okay, right? So Fiona and Greg, they get dressed and say, we're going to go check out like what it looks like. Can we get out of here? You stay here. We'll be back. We also see there's a bunch of goats running around outside. That's so the goats fun. Seem fine. Allison, it's like blizzarding outside, and out the window in a distance, Ruthie sees a figure approaching. Mm-hmm. She runs outside to be like, oh, do you own the house? Maybe you're from here. You'd be like, right. Oh, are you a local? Anything? Can you help us? Yeah. Yes. Allison, we see through the white that the figure is wearing a hooded dark shroud that billows in the wind.
I mean, it's just, it's not a like, I'm here to help outfit.
We haven't done a limerick in a while.
Oh, hit me.
If they're wearing a shroud, shit's gonna get loud.
I like that.
Does that mean anything? No, but we'll do it.
I think it does.
So obviously Ruthie stops and looks at this person. It's obviously a ghost or a spirit or something. And you could hear its footsteps crunching in the snow. So it is material. And then the figure starts running towards her. Mm-mm. And Ruthie's managed to get inside and locks the door. And then hears furious banging. And Greg and Fiona calling to her from outside the door. But of course...
But they were asleep inside.
Well, so they had gone to look at the ridge. Oh. So they are outside, but how do you know if it's them or not, right?
Right.
Versus, is this something using their voice? But she's like, fuck it. Opens the door. Thank God it's actually George and Fiona. But they do have bad news. They're completely snowed in. They literally can't get down the side of the mountain. Like, they're going to get in an avalanche. It's impossible. Yeah. Ruthie starts screaming. It's like, we have to get out of here. I saw this thing in the snow. We're like, it'll be fine. We'll all stay together. We didn't see anything out there. I think maybe we're just all really upset, and I understand that. So we'll get through it, and then we'll leave tomorrow, you know? In the middle of the night, Allison, we get this terrifying shot. One of my favorite shots in the movie, where Ruthie's asleep, and we hear this, like, low whispering. And then we see Paul. Paul is up and crouched over her and is whispering in her ear while she's asleep. Frantically.
No.
Manically.
I don't like that.
Allison, when they all wake up in the morning, Paul is gone. Well, his jacket is missing.
Okay.
And there are footsteps out into the white of the day. Luckily, it's not snowing anymore, but it's like,
but it's still a ton of snow. Yeah.
Allison, day three. This is the thing is, if this happens to me, if I'm Paul, at this point, just leave my ass and you guys go.
Yeah.
Like, if I'm gone, just leave me.
Just go.
Truly. Don't do what's about to happen. But of course, they follow the footsteps back to the rope bridge, which actually is in the right direction. So that's not, they're not losing time.
Okay.
And Paul is sitting, much like Greg found him, sitting cross-legged in the cave. And he is sitting at the foot of the bridge, blowing the bone flute. Ooh. Greg, of course, freaks out. He's like, what the fuck are you doing? You scared everybody.
What the fuck are you doing?
But Fiona's trying to be nice to Paul. And it's like, well, so what's wrong, sweetheart? And Greg and Fiona start going at each other. It's like, everyone, please. The empty man is going to show up. We have to hold it together for
each other. We haven't even gotten to the empty man yet.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Paul looks up at Greg and he's sort of whispering. And Greg sort of bends down to see what Paul's saying. And when he does, Ruthie takes out a knife.
Okay.
Stabs Greg and then slashes Fiona's throat before pushing both of them into the ravine.
What the fuck?
And we see Ruthie with the knife.
And Ruthie's the one who had blown on the flute, too.
She blew on the flute. She blew on the flute, and she saw the shrouded figure.
Mm-hmm.
And she turns back to Paul, and they sort of make eye contact, and the image distorts for a second, and Ruthie allows herself to fall backwards into the ravine. Mm-hmm. And Paul then proceeds to continue blowing on the bone flute. Title card, The Empty Man, Allison.
Oh.
And I said, after seeing this, hell yeah, that's how you fucking do it.
That's how you fucking start a horror movie.
Unfortunately, I still like the movie, but like I was like, okay, great. We're going to be in the mountains. It's going to be snowy. Like I was on board with all the touch points.
Sure, sure.
But we are now moving to 2018 and we are in Webster Mills, Missouri. And we are meeting our protagonist, James LaSombra, mm-hmm. who's a retired detective who now owns a security company, like a small town security company. Mm-hmm. We see him going for a jog. He lights up a cigarette. And I will say, this is a lot of bridges in this movie.
Okay.
And I do love that because St. Louis is a very, like, there's a ton, like, it's a bridge town.
Yeah.
Like, there's a river, a beautiful river.
A lot of bridges. That,
yeah. And so I did appreciate the bridges motif and then a lot of bridge scenes mm-hmm. that were all
nice.
Beautifully done. But as he runs, he smokes, he's haunted by a woman's voice saying, where were you? Where were you? We see him go to his security shop. This woman's like trying to buy pepper spray. He's like, let me get you this other one. It's cheaper and it works better. You don't have to shake it. Okay. Because when you're in those moments, you're not going to want to shake it. You're not going to remember. We see he like makes keys. He installs security cameras. He does it all in this town. He also goes to a Mexican restaurant and just starts taking shots of tequila alone after getting lunch. And we see him. He takes out a birthday coupon. It's his birthday, and he's drinking alone. And he gives it to the waitress for the meal. And he's like, I just want to use this. And then here's the tip. Take the tip, you know. And as he's sitting there, the waitress comes back with all the wait staff, and they give him a piece of birthday flan, and they sing happy birthday, and he's humiliated.
Birthday flan.
I did make me want birthday flan.
I do like flan.
James drives home. He gets the mail, and he sees in his backyard Amanda, who's a teen girl from his town, and he says, how's your mom doing? So there's obviously something had happened, something in the past with James and Amanda's mother. And she says, my mom sent me to come check on you. It's, you know, we know it's like almost the year anniversary. Okay. So we find out the reason that they've kind of been bonded to one another. They'd known each other before, but last year, Amanda's father, so her mother, you know, her mother's name is Nora. So Nora's husband died right around when James's wife and son, Allison and Henry, also died in a car accident. So two families decimated by tragedy and brought together by grief. So he's sort of like a paternal figure in Amanda's life, you know, not full-on stepdad, but, you know, someone who's around that she feels comfortable talking to. Unfortunately, and I think what's sad is, like, this has happened, like, this conversation with a loved one before where, you know, he's like, you know, it's been a year and, like, it's been really hard, but she tells him,
I found something so wonderful and so freeing. And it's helped me to realize that nothing can hurt you. Because nothing is real.
Mm. It's like, oh, it's a cult, isn't it? Mm. And it's interesting, like, what themes that emerge about the cult. Because, like, it's obviously Scientology.
Yeah.
But there's also, like, it's a critique of, say, Buddhism. Or it's a critique of all religion. But it's, like, it is also, I think, playing on these ideas of, like, the collective unconscious. But she's come over, like, actually, you don't have to be sad that your whole family fucking horribly died on a snowy night. Because nothing is real. It's like, well, and James is like, well, you know, a lot of things are real. And she says, well, how could you know that? And James says, well, I had to learn the hard way. It's like, well,
I'm alive.
What is real, sure, right. In some sense. But other words, it's like, yeah, we all live in the world and we see things that happen.
Yeah, I don't know stuff happens.
And she says, well, you know, like the power of positive thinking. It's like, what we think about with repetition and intention, we manifest. He's like, okay, we have heard of The Secret. But she says, what if those thoughts didn't come from us? What if those thoughts came from somewhere else? And it could give us like these like important, powerful, singular thoughts. What if there's a way to get thoughts from somewhere else? Just then her mom leaves. James doesn't even get a chance to reply.
Yeah.
And she says to James, can I tell my mom I saw you? And he's like, that's totally fine. So clearly there's some connection between James and Nora, but they are on the outs. So they're no longer in communique. And it's been a rough year for everybody. So, you know, we'll find out what happened. And James says, thank you for checking in on me. And Amanda leaves. We go up to bed. He's also drunk. Like every night we see him, he's obviously been drinking for hours alone. And we hear his wife, what we now know is his wife, Allison's voice saying, where were you? And we see a flash of them together in the park. And then a flashing police light. We get shots of like a dangling rosary from a rearview window, referencing a car accident, obviously. He goes and takes his medication, Dexapin, which I believe is antidepressant. But look, I mean, if your whole family dies in a car accident, they used to treat anxiety or depression. Yeah, so, and insomnia. Well, it's quite a water drug. We're not being paid. It's just they show the label.
Yourself
so I looked it up. Yeah. He's obviously medicated. We see his wedding ring is in the medicine cabinet. Mm. We also see on the screen, Allison, day one. Over at their place, Amanda's mom, Nora, calls up to Amanda. You got to eat. I'm taking you to school. So she's like a junior or senior, like older in high school. She says, come down here, please. She goes up to her daughter's room, which has an ensuite bathroom. She walks into the bathroom and gasps. We see her call James. James arrives. Nora shows him Amanda is gone. And written on the blood on the mirror in blood, it says, the empty man made me do it.
Oh, boy.
They call the police. The police arrive. They take sample statements. We see that the image of a seated praying man, which we've already seen in 1995, sort of reoccurring. She has a lot of artwork where she's drawn this seated praying man.
Okay.
And the cops are like, oh, wait, James. Yeah, you used to be a cop, right? I heard about you. You're out of the force now, huh? So good thing you could call us. Just cop bullshit.
Yeah.
And so they start trying to ask Nora, like, how Amanda was doing. And Nora, of course, does the same thing, which we already saw Rufy did, which, like, it's perfect. Our relationship's perfect. Amanda's doing great. It's like, you don't have to do that. She's gone.
Yeah.
Like, but it is hard. I mean, in the past, like, they would just tell you that she disappeared. I mean, like, I'm sure they were, like, run away. And so she doesn't want to admit that, which I totally understand. But, you know, recently Amanda was crying in class and the school did have to call Nora, but also her dad died. It doesn't seem that crazy to be like, a teenager is really emotional one day.
Yeah.
That's normal, right?
Yeah.
It also like stress of school, but they tell her, look, technically, okay, so Amanda is 18. So technically she's legally an adult and she did appear to take her suitcase. So, and what they're about to say is, so we're not really going to do anything. Mm. Nora, of course, flips out and was like, she is my child. She wouldn't have left like this. We weren't fighting. It wasn't like that. And the cops say, we'll see what we could do. The implication would be like, we're not going to
do anything.
Much. Meanwhile, we see one of the other cops is going through Amanda's diary. And he sort of whispers to the other officer talking to Nora and who asks her, do you have any pets? She says, no. The cops are like, oh, that's fine. No reason. We just want to ask. Meanwhile, James then takes a look at Amanda's diary because he's there, you know, kind of checking out the room as well. And he finds a flyer for the Pontifex Institute, which, again, I immediately connect. I assumed it was Scientology, right? And he sees written in her diary, he's here, he's there, he's every fucking where. And he asks Nora, who's he? And she's like, I don't know. Like, Amanda does a lot of poetry and stuff. Like, I always assume it's her dad. You know what I mean? Like, you know, and you read that, it's like, that could be your dead father. Like, you know, 100%. You're working through some stuff. And the cops leave eventually and say they'll be in touch. And Nora says, look, why do they ask about pets? And James says, well, I think they think maybe that the blood on the mirror isn't human. They think it might be animal blood.
Ooh.
And I'm like, I guess that's better because a human wasn't injured, but also, oh, no.
Oh, no.
And Nora lights up. Everybody smokes in this movie and it looks so goddamn good. Which
it's
is another
like
thing
such
I'm like,
a good horror movie. Like,
yeah.
It tells you all about, like, where someone's at.
Yes,
like,
absolutely.
Like,
yeah,
in
everyone
these
is
films,
in
like,
distress.
Where it's like, okay, got it. Know where they're going. Like, know what their whole deal is.
Yeah, it's either these two whose, like, daughter or surrogate stepdaughter has disappeared, or you see people in the cult we eventually meet up with who are, they're in a cult. So they're out smoking all the time.
Yeah.
And James is like, look, I used to be a cop. Their theory is Amanda is distressed. You guys had a fight. She's acting out to hurt you, but she's probably going to just come back and be fine. Mm-hmm. Which actually is, I've read this thing where it's like, that is what happens most of the time. Like, but it's just like, you just don't know, right?
Right. And if it's that small percentage of the time,
exactly.
That's not it, then it's like a tragedy, you know?
Exactly. And then, you know, so Nora says, they aren't going to do anything. We both know it. So I'm going to need you to do it. Would you essentially be a private investigator and find my daughter?
Okay.
Allison, I got to ask, what would you do at this point?
What would you do?
And I'm going to clarify. I'm not saying if you were James. I'm saying if you were Allison Leiby, what would you be doing?
Mm.
Would you take this on?
No.
I would, but with the idea, like, just so you know, I will be murdered by a cult by the end of this.
Yeah.
Like, I will be thrown in a ravine. I know that.
I mean, I guess it would be, like, it would be something to focus on. You know?
You're right. Just get you out of your
Sometimes,
house.
Sometimes, like, having, like, a specific task can kind of like shake you into a good place, but I don't think
that's really what
happens here.
No, but I mean, I'm optimistic. I really like that. That's a good point. Yeah.
Like that, you know, it's like, oh, giving you purpose in life and like giving you something to kind of like spend your waking hours thinking about, like, yeah, I guess I would just to kind of be like, what else am I doing?
Yeah, absolutely. So James takes it on. Obviously he's connected to this family. So he's going to try to find Amanda. So he has Nora give him a list of her closest friends. And he goes outside the high school, and when he sees one of them, Devara, coming over, he says, oh, are you friends with Amanda? Can I talk to you? Because everyone knows that she's missing now. It's all over school. Mm-hmm. And Devara says, can I have a cigarette? He says, yes, you can sit in the car. And so he sets his phone to record. So he's always recording everything, which is smart. And so she sits in his pickup truck, and they smoke a cigarette. And he says, well, you know, Nora said that she was really upset and crying the other day in class. And Devara says, she wasn't crying in class. She was screaming. That's what the cops came and already talked to us about it. And I told them she was screaming. Meanwhile, Devar keeps looking out the window, like really scared, nervous. We see like other kids looking in the window. We're not sure who exactly she's looking at. She's like, look, cops already came. I told them everything I know. I don't know where she is. And James says, well, in that case, could you tell me something about the empty man? And she's like,
some story started going around that if you went to a bridge after dark, you found an empty bottle. If you blew into it, and you thought about him, something would happen.
And he says, so did you do that? And Devar says, 2 days ago we did.
Okay.
So we see Amanda and Devar.
And we're on day two. Like, we...
So this is day one for James. It would be day two for Amanda. So she's a day ahead of him.
Okay.
Much like the ring. Like, it's like people are kind of staggered. But, yeah, so it's day two for Amanda. She's disappeared. And day two, to remember, well, we'll get into it, what those different days mean. But basically, Devar tells us that she and Amanda went with their other friends, Lisa, Duncan, Meyer, and Brendan, and that bitch Jillian, who we can't stand, which I appreciated that. They go to the bridge, and they, like, go down under the bridge, which I would not do this shit, but I obviously you're a teenager, you're doing whatever. Mm-hmm. Like, you could pull a manhole up and then get into, like, a utility catwalk.
Yeah,
assuming they go down there to, like, give each other blowjobs or whatever.
Yeah, it's not for me, but, like, I get
it. Right, exactly. For teens. You're just smoking weed down there. Yeah. So most of them crawl back up, and Amanda and Brendan are talking, and Amanda tells Brendan, like, she tried to commit suicide after her dad died. She's like, yeah, look at my scars. But then she goes, psych, these are just scars from when I rollerbladed into a plate glass window.
Oh, my God.
And they're like, oh. And she says, you know, if I ever were to kill myself, I'd do it the proper way. As they walk across the bridge, Allison, Amanda spots a bottle, and she's the one who explains the empty man legend. She says, you know, the first night you'll hear him coming for you, and you can't stop thinking about him. The second night you'll see him following you. Mm-hmm. And on the third night, he finds you. Devar and Jillian both want to leave. I was like, Jillian might be a bitch, but she's right about this.
No, she's correct.
Like, I don't want to do this.
You should definitely leave.
Yeah. But Duncan grabs the bottle and blows, and then everyone kind of peer pressures each other to do it. Devar is the last one. She's like, this is bullshit. This is stupid kid stuff. But of course, they're like, oh, if it's kid stuff, then why are you afraid of it? And she goes, who? And then, like, just hands it, like, just a little teeny who, which is very funny. And then
that'd be me, like, peer pressured into, like,
summoning a demon.
Yeah, summoning a demon.
Absolutely. And she then gives the bottle to Amanda, who has already done it, but then goes again and sits in the middle of the bridge and blows on the bottle again, clearly hoping it's actually real.
Yeah.
And she whispers, the empty man, starts thinking about it. And they all sort of stare into the darkness. The end of the bridge is just a footbridge. So, like, the end is total darkness as it goes into the forest. And the wind starts blowing, and they hear in the darkness a distant rattling sound, the sound of a bottle falling over. And then footsteps running towards them.
No.
So everyone hauls out of there at least. They escape and they all go home. And now that she's in James's car, Devar tells him, at the mall the next day, I saw Amanda whispering to Brendan. So this was yesterday. She's like, I saw Amanda whispering to Brendan, much like how we saw Paul whispering in Ruthie's ear. Like, just this, like, and Devar saw that and was scared. But again, she's a teenager. She's like, I didn't like say anything to her. I just like walked away. Meanwhile, we see her looking out the window, and we see five kids sitting cross-legged praying on the sidewalk.
No.
And she gets out and gives him the other kids' addresses and says, oh, this is where Brendan lives, and walks off, clearly terrified. James then goes to Brendan's house. Allison, Brendan is also missing.
Not great.
He goes to Lisa Schwartz's house. No one's home, or are they? No, they're not, but the TV is on. It's playing Spartacus, and one of the characters says, what did he say? The god is coming? A new god? So I appreciated that little, you know, sprinkle. He goes into, because nobody's home when the door is open, he goes to Lisa's bedroom. She also has, like, pamphlets from the Pontifex Institute.
Okay.
And it says, would you like to see the world in a whole new way?
No.
And he goes in the backyard, and he finds that Schwartz's dog has been murdered. Its throat cut. So that's where we got the
animal
blood.
Came from.
Yeah. James calls Nora and says, okay, so all of Nora's friends are also missing, except for Devara. Mm. She's, you know. And then I was like, well, we'll get to Devara. And he asks her, did Amanda ever bring up the Pontifex Institute? But Nora says, no, I never heard of this. And he's like, okay, well, I found it. I'm going to investigate it. Thinking naturally, it's like, okay, great. Due to the grief with her father, she and these kids found out about this thing, and now they're, like, getting sucked into a cult, which unfortunately has happened and, like, does happen when people are in crisis, you know? Yeah. James goes down to the footbridge where the summoning took place to sort of check it out and see, like, if there's any evidence about where they all might have gone. And he walks across a bridge. Allison, he picks up a bottle. And he absentmindedly just blows across it.
Is that like a natural, like, would you
That's
do
what the
that?
Movie suggests. I would never pick a dirty bottle off the ground.
I certainly wouldn't put it up to my mouth.
Put it near any of my soft apertures and blow on it to what end? Like, and then also, you are required to think of the empty man, but I'm assuming he is if he's doing it. It's like, this process is making me think of him naturally.
Okay.
Allison, as soon as he does it, all the sound in the movie cuts out.
Whoa.
So no insects, no distant train, no birds, and then it returns. But for one split second, clearly something has happened.
Okay.
He finds the manhole where we saw the kids climbing out of, and he opens the manhole and he climbs down onto the utility catwalk, and he finds all of Amanda's friends dead, hanging, having hung themselves from the bottom of the bridge.
Oh my God.
And written on a beam across their bodies, it says, "The empty man made me do it."
Wait, why are we assuming that they've hung themselves? Just that they've been hanged, not like...
They've been hanged. You're right. It appears to be suicide, but we don't know yet. Okay. We have no evidence yet about what actually happened. So he calls the cops. They come to pull the bodies up. And they're also like dredging the water, being like, did Amanda fall? Like, was she also there? And like, maybe she fell off of here. No Amanda. Obviously, everyone in town is devastated. Like, this horrible thing. They're trying to figure out what's happening. And James takes out the Pontifex flyer, and his nose starts bleeding. Mm. So he's constantly returning to, like, he's having nosebleeds throughout the movie. We then see Devara at a spa, which sounds heavenly.
I would love to be at a spa right now.
And she undresses and goes into the steam room. And I will say that is the one thing as a teenage girl I would not have done. Like, there's no one else there, so maybe I would have done it totally nude. But, like, the way she does it, I was like, she's still a teen girl. You'd still be like, yeah. Is anyone in here? You know, like, I'll have my towel. Like, there'd be a level of, like, you know what I mean, self-consciousness.
Yes.
Unfortunately, Allison, as the steam fills the room, a hooded, shrouded figure appears and approaches Devara. And before she could even react, it lifts a pair of scissors and stabs her in the face over and over again.
Look, there's a lot of ways you can die. I don't want that to be how I do.
Top five ways I don't want to die, stabbing myself repeatedly in the face with scissors. I agree. Unfortunately, when we cut to what's really happening, Devara is stabbing herself in the face. So in her mind, she is seeing the shrouded figure.
Yes, but in reality, she's...
Exactly. Okay. She collapses, dying, and the hooded figure closes her eyes, right? So down at the station, James is talking to one of the detectives. Detective Villiers, I'm going to say, or Villiers.
Sure.
And who tells him Devara also is dead. So everyone except Amanda is dead from that friend group who was on the bridge that night, except Amanda's still missing.
Okay.
And the detective says, we think it was a suicide. She stabbed herself in the face. And James says, people don't die that way. Like, that's not the way you take your own life. That's insane. Yeah. And the detective says, exactly my point. Like, we know this is fucked up. We know something is happening. But then they're like, is it a cult thing? Like, and spoiler alert, is attached to a cult, obviously. But they don't know about the shrouded figure. We have a little more intel at this point. Mm-hmm. So James leaves, and the detective tells him, the detective tells him 3 weeks ago in Maryville, a woman fed her infant to a pack of stray dogs.
What the fuck?
Claiming that the baby was whispering to her. And in the kitchen, she wrote, "The empty man made me do it." And we found the same written on the tile next to Devara's body in her own blood. So needless to say, the detective is thinking it's a serial killer.
Yes.
So he's like, we got to catch this bastard.
That's like first logical thought.
Yes, absolutely. Like the empty man, you know, it's a Ted Bundy, whatever. Sure. This guy's like wilding out. But he's like, the thing about catching, even if we catch this guy, like we'll never solve these kinds of crimes because there is no logic to them. Mm-hmm. He's like, we can't indict the cosmos. Like that's the problem is like we can catch an individual who's doing evil things or like bad things. But what creates this is something out of our control, which I think is an interesting point. And kind of what I think Twin Peaks is about. Like, it's sort of like the uncontrolled. We try to talk about good and evil because we don't understand both the cosmos, but also ourselves, why we do certain things. So, but he's like, we got to find this guy. This guy's out here killing people, making people feed their baby to the devil or whatever, or to dogs. That night, James listens to his recording with Devara, and he looks at the Pontifex Institute. No surprise here. He finds the Wikipedia. It says on the Wikipedia article that it is a doomsday cult. And on the page, the content index says, and here are the entries, opposition and controversies, history of the Pontifex Institute, cave outside Agaba, Jordan, the Ura Valley, Bhutan, the move to St. Louis, the Pontifex Society, and the occult, which I did think was funny. It was like, we're in Jordan, we're in Bhutan, and then, baby, we're in beautiful St. Louis. See you in St. Louis, a cult that is calling to the empty man. We also see a section called Incident in the Missouri Woods. And I did like how they did this because it reminded me of, you know, within Blair Witch, you have sort of like the other stories.
Yes.
Like, you know, the incident at Coffin Rock. Right. Like, that's not the inciting incident, but like the idea that like this
is not,
there are related catastrophes. Yeah. And so this one, in 1991, six young men murdered each other, and the last one died by suicide. In a cabin in the woods in the Mark Twain National Forest in an attempt to allegedly manifest a tulpa. Now, have you heard of a tulpa before, Allison?
No.
I feel like this was like a sort of a, back when conspiracy theories, like cryptids were just getting started. Yeah. There were a lot of tulpa talk.
I have never heard that word before.
So it has, luckily in the movie, he looks it on Wikipedia. I'm like, this guy, I like the cut of his jib. This is exactly what I mean. He doesn't even go to your local library. He's just looking at Wikipedia,
which
I appreciate.
You know what? That's all we need.
Yeah. And then written, he sees on the back of Amanda's Pontifex flyer, it says the word tulpa. So I'm like, she's like, okay, so she was involved in this. So basically, according to the Wikipedia article in this movie, a tulpa, which is a concept taken from Tibetan Buddhism, is the idea that you could create a materialized being in the real world, typically a human, created through spiritual practice and intense concentration. So the idea that like the human mind can manifest a person or an entity or a creature just by thinking about it.
Okay.
And the equation on Wikipedia is thought plus concentration plus time equals flesh. Now, of course, that's an interesting concept. And in this movie, we're taking it literally.
Yes.
Right? I'm sure within Buddhism, that's, you know, there's nuances to the
this
idea.
Is like, that's what it means.
Yes, exactly. We're taking it, much like, I mean, like Catholicism and the Exorcist. Like, we are, the devil is literally here.
Yes.
Nora calls him just to check in. And she says, actually, I'm outside. I got dinner. So as soon as she walks in, she's holding dinner. She just bursts into tears. And haven't we all had those entrances into our friends and loved ones' homes? And she's crying. And she's like, I'm sorry, I'm crying. And he says, you don't have to apologize. Like, and she says, I do. I'm sorry I haven't seen you in so long, and I'm sorry about the circumstances about why I haven't seen you. But of course, we don't know all of it.
We don't know those. Yeah.
But clearly, they're close. They were closer. There's an estrangement. Mm-hmm. We're trying to figure it out. So she asks if she could stay the night, and he balks. And she says, okay, boundaries. So he is the one setting up the boundaries, right? We see Allison. We see James drinking again heavily, staggering to bed without Nora. And he hears Allison, his wife's voice again, saying, where were you? Where were you? Where were you? And we also hear Devara telling us again, the first night you hear him, and we see flashes of his family in the car accident, and we see Allison, his wife, looking into the back seat. And there's a constant motif of his son Henry like hitting a quarter against his teeth, which would have made my parents go insane.
Yeah.
You can't be doing that. But we kind of hear the clinking of the quarter against his tooth sort of as like a motif in certain scenes. So again, just like literal things that I appreciate them sort of weaving into like these larger sound, you know. I appreciate the care. So James jerks awake at 3:03 a.m. to hear footsteps walking through his house. And I wrote, it's 3 a.m., the topo's lonely.
Lonely.
He slams his bedroom door as the footsteps get closer and closer, and he grabs a bat.
Okay.
And he finally flings open the bedroom door, and of course, there's no one there, but his front door is standing wide open.
I don't like it.
No. And so he goes in the morning, wakes up, he takes his medication. We see his wedding ring there again. And there's a certain moment of like, oh, am I imagining this? Like, is this stress? What's happening? We, of course, see on the screen as he gets into his car as day breaks, day two. He's listening to a radio report about the dead teenagers. He's, you know, everyone in town is talking about it.
Obviously.
And he drives into the big city, St. Louis, where the Pontifex Institute has a building. And it's very Scientology. He walks in. There's like a very robotic blonde receptionist who gives him a clipboard. And she says, you know, we were established in 2013, but what we can offer you is as old as time itself. James like, okay, great. I'll go ahead and fill this out. Thank you.
Thank you.
So he goes and sits down to take a personality assessment, which again, I'm not saying it's one-to-one Scientology, but when I think of like you go in to get assessed, yes, it's Scientology.
That's a very Scientology thing.
I'll say, so he has to answer yes or no to certain statements. I'm going to read some of them, Allison. Can you tell me yes or no? Okay, yes or no, life itself is a kind of disease.
No.
Okay, great. The brain can itch, yes or no?
I mean, maybe.
Okay, that you have to pick one.
Yes.
Okay, great. Suicide is a form of thought control.
No.
The entire universe is an erogenous zone.
Yes.
Well, I think it's interesting because, like, this is not a sexy movie and no one has, like, it's not, like, sex, it comes up a little bit, but it's not like
a sexy movie. We've done some sexy
movies. Well,
that's
what I was thinking. I was like, oh, okay, now okay, this is a cult that fucks.
Something, but it's
not,
it's like, nah, it's just a random. All right.
Yeah. And then an infection is a blessed event.
No.
Allison, we turn the page, we see even more. The scientific method is a tool of oppression.
No.
And here's what we get into. There's actually a number of prompts that I think are just fully transphobic. Yeah. Like one of them says, science says the genders are discrete.
Yeah, that feels transphobic.
And then I went, menstruation is no basis on which to determine gender. And then finally, and I'm going to stop you right here, Pontifex Institute, a woman is just as likely to have a penis as a man. And I was like, well, apparently I'm on the other side of some of these things in the tulpa. You're telling me that you're going to conjure an empty man from some sort of like other dimension of knowledge, and that guy's going to be transphobic when he gets here? Yeah, unacceptable.
It seems unlikely.
Come on. Yeah, you're beyond thought, beyond time, beyond the human body, and
but
you're going to be transphobic.
Still, like, hung
with
up
it?
On like a gender binary?
The next page, Allison. True or false? Rational thought is deadly.
False.
An individual mind is a single cell in a large consciousness.
False.
See, I think that's not literally true, but it is figuratively true.
Figuratively so me, like, true, yes. But
well,
like literally.
We are part of a collective. Exactly.
Yeah, no.
Everything is permissible.
No.
To give myself to something larger would be completely fulfilling.
Not completely.
And finally, until a civilization has fallen, it has not yet served its purpose.
I mean, this is a really whack way of looking at the world.
And it's like, we'll find out soon, America.
Yeah,
this
yeah,
the thing
we're
kind of like,
headed there. Is this America?
And this is, exactly. I would say, like, being online, you know, as we all have to be, some of the fact that we have things that I think are, like, sort of edgelord libertarian ideas, and then just full-on transphobia, well, it just puts me in the mind of, like, what's interesting about this is, like, I do feel like there is some sense in, like, the terror of this movie is the idea that we are going to go beyond, like, all boundaries, go move beyond our sense of, like, what is real. And there is something where people think of that, think of transgender people not as, like, a part of the simple natural variety as the animals we are as a species. Yeah. Like, every fucking animal has on the God. Like, it has, and you know what I mean? Like, we are seeing ourselves, rather than seeing ourselves as, like, an insane project that we have to control.
Yeah.
And again, you see how society is affected by this in all this different ways. Like, we have to be punished back into these roles.
Yes.
And like, and so the scary thing is, like, what if you thought too hard and reality didn't, you know, reality came apart? It's like, grow up. What are you, 13?
Yeah.
Your first philosophy class? Like, what the fuck are you talking about? Like, anyways, grow up, empty man. Anywho, James goes up to the receptionist desk and says, what is this? And she says, the first step on your spiritual journey. And she said, he says, no, not the assessment. I get that part. I'm from San Francisco. I mean, what's this? And we see on the clipboard is the same image from Amanda's room of the seated man praying.
Okay. Great.
So he's like, so what? He's like, oh, honey, I'm from San Francisco. You don't have to worry about that. I get this all mumbo jumbo. That makes sense
we're
to
good.
Me.
But this
right.
Image.
What is this? Yeah. What does the image mean? But she doesn't have a chance to answer. The next seminar is about to begin. So James and a bunch of other people who are sort of like wandering off the street or were interested, they're ushered into a lecture hall. And then surrounding the lecture hall are sort of like, what do you call them? They're like little booths where you sit up, like box seats. They're box seats with actual cult members who are in the cult who are all wearing beige suits. They're all like really done up and like well-polished. And then like the floor seats are from people who are just here to hear about what this is about, you know? And so we also see as they walk in and, James does not clock it, that there's a painting of the house in Bhutan where our original four characters were staying. And I guess if he had seen it, it has no meaning to him.
Right.
But we are now meeting the founder of the Pontifex Institute. And that is, of course, the cult leader, Arthur Parsons. And he is giving his speech. And again, he's played by Stephen Root, who's great.
Oh, I love Stephen Root.
Right. He was just in Barry. I will always think of him as Milton from Office Space.
Milton from Office Space.
And this does feel like where Milton could end up next, leading a cult. And he tells them great news, everyone.
There is nothing you have lost. More than that, there is no such thing as loss.
And there's the thing, it was like, I disagree with the assessment, but I also disagree with this, where it's just sort of like, we deny the concept of right and wrong. There is no right and wrong. It's like, yes, obviously we all agree that we shouldn't go, like, there are certain boundaries, that's one of them. There is our concept of right and wrong. But he says, all there is the great binding nothingness of things. We were all one. Once we were all one, we will all be one again. And this message comes to you directly from the empty man. So, of course, James is like, oh, the empty man came up. All right. And he says, the empty man beckons you to discover the true face of the world. And all the newbies clap, and then the suited cult members clap, and they, like, stomp their feet up in the box seats. Afterwards, everyone gets to meet Arthur, like, shake his hand. People want autographs. Again, like L. Ron Hubbard, I'm assuming. Yeah. And James approaches and says, so what is the empty man? And Arthur breaks down the cult's philosophy to the best of his ability for this film.
Okay.
So basically, he says, in the same way that humans breathe air from the atmosphere and eat food from the biosphere, we also receive thoughts from the noosphere, which is what they call the sum of all collective thought. So the idea is, like, they think that if you focus and meditate, you will be able to access these thoughts that exist outside of you, but you could use, and they could be really helpful to us. And he says, the empty man ritual is a meditative practice to allow you to sort of drop ideas from the noosphere. And he said, basically, like, the cult's ultimate goal is to move, to erase the line between form and flesh. So they want to be able to manifest real things using thought.
Okay.
And his example of this, which again is like, we need to do a Pontypool, a really excellent movie, if you're listening to this. Because it's also about, like, language and thought and sort of the breakdown of both. And so Arthur's pitch or way to describe this is, like, you know when you say your name enough times, it loses all meaning? That's actually true of every thought.
Okay.
So you can actually lose, again, look at society. It's like, you can think anything.
Sure.
And then you convince yourself it's true. Alternately, you could think something true and then you lose the truth of it. If you, you know, you could also lose that.
Yeah.
And he quotes Nietzsche as saying, like, when you stare into an abyss, it stares into you. And I wrote, sounds like my Friday night.
No.
He says, people have said that so much, it sort of seems like a cliche. But let's think about it. What is the abyss? What would be in the abyss that's staring back at you? That implies that both you and the abyss are capable of seeing and perceiving one another. So what if you were to, I don't know, fucking get a crack and start talking to one another?
Yeah.
What can the abyss tell us? And so he's saying, you know, you repeat your name enough times, it becomes gibberish. But the name itself hasn't changed. So what is the right interpretation? The name or the gibberish? And I was like, that's terrifying. I don't know exactly what we're talking about, but I don't like that at all.
Yeah, I really don't like it, but I also don't get it.
Yeah. And James Simley is like, okay, dude, well, thanks, cool. I guess. And Arthur says, thank you so much for coming back. I hope you stay longer next time. And James says, coming back, I've never been here before. And Arthur's like, oh, sorry, just must be something about you. You're just, you know. So James sort of goes over. They have like a coffee and donut situation. So he's over there and he starts showing a photo of
Amanda. That's
the way
to get me
around.
Into a cult.
Oh, hell yeah, absolutely. And the movie's over. He just joins a cult. He's showing like a photo of a man on his phone. He talks to this guy, this younger man, Garrett. And he's like, sorry, I don't recognize her. But James is like, no, this all seems like exactly what I thought. She and her friends got sucked into this fucking cult. She came here. And now she's living here, or she's part of this, and she's run away from home, and now I'm going to find her, you know. So he sneaks upstairs. So he's sneaking into the actual institute.
Okay.
And he finds a long hallway, sort of like almost like a hangar full of cots, like a dorm for the students. Mm-hmm. And in the dorm, a broadcasting voice that says, nothing exists. Even if something exists, nothing could be known about it. Even if something can be known, knowledge cannot be communicated to others. Even if it can be communicated, it cannot be understood. It's like, okay, girl. And then we find a bunch of bald guys praying, staring at the wall at a black poster on the wall. And they're all whispering. So, and here's the thing I wrote. I've been enjoying all this, but we have about an hour left, and I'm going to need to get to the
That's
empty
insane.
Man. Girl, yes. And, because again, they kept it moving, but then I looked at the time, I'm like, I thought we were
ramping up
into it. You know what I mean? So, they're staying at the black poster, and I think it's like they're focusing on the void to try to communicate with the void. They're staring at the abyss, hoping that something will stare back and give them these thoughts or this information they don't have access to, right? Worth a shot. Yeah, what else are you doing with your time? So he slinks into the archive room, and we see a file labeled Manifestation 14. And there's all these files from the cult. And then he finds a room in the basement. It looks like an AA meeting. And a bunch of people are sitting around in folding chairs in front of a freestanding chalkboard, and they're chanting, from his thoughts come the dreams, from his dreams come the power, from the power comes the bridge, from the bridge comes the man, from the man comes his thoughts. Of course, James, as he walks out of the catwalk, immediately, like, kicks a can or something. Yeah. But then everyone, because he's sort of in the shadow, they think it's the empty man. Oh. So they're like, oh,
he's here.
You're with us. Tell us. Allison, then there is a rattle. And then there is a sound. And it implies that they are conjuring the empty man.
Right.
And then they all lifted their empty bottles and blew, which I thought was a little cheesy, but you got it. You know, that's what the ritual we've set up. Yeah. They blow the bottles. Suddenly, all the lights turn on, exposing James to the catwalk, and two cult members said, sir, can you please come with us? And they haul him out.
Is blowing
the
bottle supposed to be, like, analogous to blowing the flute?
Yes, okay. I think so. I think there's just, like, conjuring him, like, some, like, a almost like a incantation that we're setting up. Yeah, I'm not sure exactly sure why blowing versus, like, saying a limerick. I don't know, but... So they throw him in the alley, and he sees Garrett, the young man that he showed Amanda's photo to, who's out there smoking. And he's like, oh, yeah, you'll never get anywhere with them like that. They're far out, you know? And he gives James a cigarette. They smoke out in the rain. And he's like, look, I did see that girl. I saw Amanda. She was here, but they sent her downstate to the Pontifex camp where they send you to get pre-PR'd, pre-released.
It's like the Scientology semester at sea thing.
Yes, unfortunately, exactly. And he's Sea Org. He's like, well, it's the first threshold to achieving singularity. And so James is like, oh, God damn it. She's at some sort of cult camp.
Oh.
And he says, I could tell you where it's at, though. It's off Route 32. It's in the Mark Twain National Forest near the Merrimack Bridge. And James drives down there and finds a camp elsewhere. Of course, it appears abandoned. He doesn't see anyone. And he ends up kind of sneaking into the office building. So they're all like discreet individual cabins. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the records room. Mm-hmm. So he gets in there. He finds Amanda's file. He finds all the other teens' files. Allison, he finds a file. It's bright red compared to the rest of the other manila folders with his name on it. And when he opens it, it's empty inside. Almost like, I don't know, I'm going to put it out here, some kind of empty man of some sort.
Not great.
And he looks at it and he goes, yeah, okay. Which I did think this actor had a lot of funny asides, like as are in like the person who is like a real person.
Yeah.
He did a lot of moments of like, all right, what are we talking about? And this is James Badge Dale, who's from, let's see, he was in The Gray, 13 Hours, 24, The Departed, a lot of stuff. And he's great in this movie. He's our grizzled ex-cop who's trying to get to the bottom of things. But is there a bottom to the abyss? We'll find out. He goes into another cabin, and they're all filthy and covered in cobwebs, like no one's been there forever. And he finds an old charred teddy bear on the ground.
Oh, that's never chilling.
Yeah. He also finds a VHS tape called Manifestation 13, and he pops it into the TV. And we see six young men chanting, and we realize this is the incident in the Missouri woods. We're watching video of the guys who all murdered each other, right? And they're chanting. Much like we heard in the Institute, they're chanting one another, and then they hear a sound, and they all stop, and then it cuts to static. When it cuts back, it's chaos. We see naked legs, broken glass on the ground, and a shirtless man sort of like seizing and spouting gibberish. Mm-hmm. And they try to put like something on his head, and then we see him frantically getting up, and he's got his hand in what I assume is somebody else's bodily organs. Oh. He's like sticking his hand, because I was like, is that his? Did he pull out his own stomach? But I think it's somebody else's.
Okay.
I guess. And he's taking someone else's blood. Yeah. And he's frantically painting the seated man on the wall. Mm-hmm. And in this one, it's the seated man outlined in blood. And then there's sort of like a T-shaped figure over it. Okay. It's not a cross or anything, but there's sort of like a little crown or something over mm-hmm. the seated figure. Night has fallen, Allison. And as James leaves the cabin, he hears chanting in the distance. And unlike you and me, he goes towards it.
Yeah, it couldn't be me.
Yeah, I would be dead sprinting back to the road. Yep. He finds a light in the trees. He follows it and he sees dozens of cult members all dressed in black dancing around a gigantic fire. And they stop and they all sort of stand swaying as James approaches. And then they start going counterclockwise. And he's hiding like basically in a marsh, like he's like among the reeds. And as they run counterclockwise, the fire seems to stretch up to the sky. And above Jim, we see the stars sort of blur, and then he blinks, disoriented, and he turns to leave when the chanting stops entirely. Mm. And when he turns back, the fire is out, and all the cult members are staring at him.
No, that's not good.
And then the stars go out, and the sounds of nature cuts out. So it's totally dark and dead silent. And when the sound and light comes back on, the cult has started slowly walking towards him. Mm. And we see him take a step back, and then collectively the cult takes one step forward. He takes another step back. They step forward. He says, yeah, no. And then he books it, and he's running. As these cult members start running after him, dead sprinting, screaming, hooting, hollering, like animalistic, chasing him down.
Yeah.
He gets to his car. Fortunately, he gets inside. Of course, it will not start right away. The cult smashes his windshield. They're tearing the car apart. And he's about to drive away. We see a cult member like stumbling off the roof. People are flying out. And finally, he's able to turn the car around, get out to the street, and he's screaming, what the fuck was that? And he peels, you know, his way back up to St. Louis mm-hmm. as a storm rolls in. He goes to the detective and says, here's everything that happened. And the detective's like, okay, so let me get this straight. You think this vulnerable teenage girl is with the cult. So you went there alone, someone who is not a cop. You took files. You broke into cabins. Please do not fuck up this investigation for me. You could have just said you thought she was down there and we could go look. And so he's like yelling at James. And James is like, you don't understand. It's not like something is going on. Like it's not a normal
crime.
It's not what you think. Yeah. Exactly. But he said, okay. He gives James a notepad to write down his entire statement. And we see James head over to his security store to stock up. So we see him get like bolt cutters, pocket knives. Like he's got everything.
Yeah.
You know, he's situated. And he goes over to Nora's house to warn her about what he saw. He's like, I don't know exactly what's happening, but if a man is involved with these people, you're in danger, and I think you should get out of here. Mm-hmm. And he closes all of her curtains, and we see sort of a white van parked on the street. And Nora says, do you think that you're telling me Amanda's with that cult? He's like, yes, I'm so sorry. I actually think the cult killed her friends. And they also, I think, know where you live because he found the files. So it's like, I think they have her address. I think we should get out of here. Of course, the phone rings, and she picks it up and then answers it and hands it to James, and it's just whispering and clicking, like the whispering we've heard, people whispering in each other's ears. And James, to his credit, says, let's get out of here right now.
Okay, thank you. Good.
Yeah. So they each take their cars to a hotel, and he's basically checking Nora into a hotel, and then he's going to go home. And Nora's outside, like outside the lobby, and she starts crying. She's like, she's dead, isn't she? And James says, I really don't think so. I don't know what's going on, but I don't think she's dead because she would have been dead with her friends.
Yeah.
And James asks Nora, did Amanda ever know about us? Did you ever tell her? And Nora's like, oh, did I tell her about that thing that we don't even talk about? No, I don't think she knew. And she says to James, don't you think we punished ourselves long enough? Of course, Nora and James were lovers. And we cut back to that night. We see Allison driving Henry in the car. And we realize, we hear Allison asking, where were you? Well, that night, James was with Nora the night of the crash.
Yeah,
that's why he wasn't in the car. And I think to her point was like, we fucked up, but both of us have been punished horribly by the cosmos. Like,
right. Can't we at least just like be normal?
Which also is funny because like, again, as someone who has like very different opinion of feelings about monogamy, where I was like, I mean, yeah, you shouldn't have done that. But like, I don't think you have to like ruin your own life.
Your whole, like, the rest of your entire life because of this one thing.
Yes. And believe me, I'm Catholic. I understand the thinking of my family died because I had sex with somebody outside of marriage. I get it. Believe me. But that isn't what happened. It's not even what happened in this movie that implies that the supernatural exists. So, yeah. You know. But, you know, obviously he's still torn up about it. And he goes home. He goes to sleep. He wakes up, of course, 3:03 again on the dot. He lights a cigarette and he looks down. He left the bedroom door open. And he sees a figure sit up from the ground in the hallway and stand up. It's, of course, a shrouded figure.
Of course.
Since it's the second day, he is seeing. He's now seeing the empty man. He shuts the door. He screams. And he hears the doorbell ring. And he goes to the door. Again, could not be me.
Nope.
Answers the door. And in the rain is the old charred teddy bear from the camp. Which I took to mean, we know where you
are. We know where you are. And we know that you've seen us.
Exactly. But I think we're to think, through that conversation with Nora, he maybe, and this is another thing too of like what we then see him do, which is in the morning he wakes up, he's about to take his pill, he doesn't take it, he puts it back in the bottle, and he puts on his wedding ring. So I was like, is he rejecting pharmaceuticals, which is a very Scientology thing?
Very Scientology.
And putting on his wedding ring, like, oh, I can finally let my, like, to me, the wedding thing makes sense. It's like, okay, finally I can move past it and really grieve because I'm not beating myself up.
Yes.
But putting the pill back, I'm like, honey, the pill is not the issue.
The pill is not the problem.
And on the screen it reads, day 3. And now I have to ask you, Allison, who will survive this film?
Who will survive?
We got James and Nora, who are really the only ones I care about.
I think
and
that
then we got,
they'll both survive.
Okay, great. And what do you think will happen? Like, what do you think will happen with the empty man?
I think he'll confront the empty man and, like, be able to maybe break the hold over people that he has.
Okay, great.
Or at least, like, for himself.
Okay, fabulous. I like it. All right, so we see James park across the street from the Pontifex Institute and wait and watch to see Garrett come out. And he trails them. And he follows them to a hospital. He walks in the hospital, and he's sort of spying on them, and they go into a room, and they try to shut the curtain, but he can sort of see what's going on. And as he watches, at least 6 to 8 cult members are forming a semicircle around a man in a hospital bed. He's unconscious. He has a respirator. And as he's watching, these cult members fall to their knees simultaneously and start praying to this guy in the hospital bed. James sort of hides himself and then follows Garrett back. And when Garrett's friend drops him off, James grabs Garrett, pepper sprays him, and throws him in the back of his car in broad daylight. And I think there is a funny moment where everyone's on their phone so they don't see this happening. Mm-hmm. Like, we see everyone else in the street is, like, looking down.
Yeah. That's fun.
However, so he throws Garrett in there and he drives him to an abandoned, a warehouse, like, behind a warehouse, right? And he's like, I'm sorry. I didn't know they were going to ambush you at the camp. I really thought she was there. I didn't know that was all happening. They don't tell me anything. And James says, I don't care about that. Who the fuck is that guy in the hospital? And Garrett says, question. I don't know his name. But he's like an antenna. He transmits thoughts that we can't get anywhere else. So everyone sort of like goes to him and spends a lot of time with him because he sort of can get us stuff from the noosphere. And, you know, unfortunately, that also means that he is in a unconscious state. Like, he's just sort of like he's a receiver. He's just receiving and playing these messages. And James takes out a gun and he puts it to Garrett's head and makes him kneel down and says, you're going to say something that makes sense. Or so help me God, I'm going to kill you. I was like, thank you. So Garrett says a lot. I don't know if much makes sense, but we'll say. Garrett says, look, they say that thoughts are transmissible, right? That their idea of the noosphere is all consciousness, but it's not just human consciousness.
Okay.
And that's what they found out is there are other minds out there, other thoughts, minds that are ancient and angry. And James says, you all are fucking morons. What are you talking about?
This would be my reaction.
100%. And Garrett tells him, you've experienced it too. Dreams, fevers, deja vu. Like, you get these flashes from somewhere else. And it kind of can only get to you when you're, like, vulnerable or sick or guilty. Like, you get, and we've seen his dreams. Like, he's revisiting his family's death over and over again. Mm-hmm. It's like, it can reach you, but we're trying to cultivate a relationship with him. And then once in a million years, there is the other. And they're like, what is that? It's like, it, basically they did like, well, they don't say the word God, but I took it as like, occasionally in the noosphere, you communicate with a God.
Okay.
You know? And so in order to do that, he needs an empty man, in this case, the guy in the hospital bed, to be the bridge.
Okay.
So they need a human body for this ancient, incredible intelligence to communicate with human beings. And the point of this, at least according to the cult, it's like he comes to release all boundaries. Like he's going to give us his godlike knowledge so that there will be, we will essentially be like him, you know? And that's what I'm saying. Like there's no reality except for him, which is how people talk about God, I think sometimes.
Yeah, I think like, that's like not so far off from some
beliefs. But then he describes, he's like, there's no reality except for him, his endless black chaos. And I'm like, well, I don't want just endless chaos. Like, can we just have like a nice time? Can we like sit in the woods?
Yeah.
And then I wrote, okay, we need to wrap this up. Like it is, we're half an hour to the end. And I'm like, we have got to beep, beep, bop, boop, do this. And, but because then Gary tells him like, man, when we finally get this set up, things are going to slide, man. It's going to be a bloodbath. And then I'm like, wait, so why would they want that to happen? Like, I understand being like, I want godlike knowledge. Okay. That makes
sense.
Sure.
But why would you
like
hope for and plan for mass and death? I don't know what that accomplishes.
Maybe it's like the, I don't know. I mean, you see these like evangelicals where it's like they want the end of the world. So I'm like, oh, is it the end of the world doesn't know it? You think it's good? So like, oh, we need to bring about this cataclysmic end. Mm-hmm. But that, so that part I was kind of rocky on. But then we look at Garrett and Garrett has like, it looks like he's having an allergic reaction. Like it's all red around his eyes. And he sees James' nose has started bleeding again, which we saw earlier. He says, see, you're coming down with him already. You got your brain is itching, isn't it? And James is like, you're full of shit. Again, I grew up in San Francisco. I've heard every woo-woo horseshit thing. That doesn't mean it's real. Tell me where fucking Amanda is.
Right.
And Garrett says, she's on the bridge. And he's like, what bridge? We live in St. Louis. And then Garrett starts laughing and says, don't you get it? There is no bridge. And then James rightfully kicks the shit out of him.
Thank you.
And just fucking punches in the face where we're all at. I'll be honest, like, no, bam. And as he's beating Garrett up, Garrett's just laughing and laughing. And he leaves them there. He drives back to the Pontifex Institute. So now it's like nightfall. There's a rainstorm coming in. And he goes to the file room and he finds the file of the guy in the hospital. Allison, do you know at this point who the guy in the hospital is?
No.
Think to the beginning of the movie.
The first guy who fell in.
Yes. It's the one who survived. The guy who fell in. Yeah. So it's Paul.
Paul.
So they actually don't know his name. We know his name. It's Paul.
Okay.
So he finds this file and, you know, again, like everyone there, he's like a John Doe because like the implication is like the cult leader found this guy or like communicated with this guy after this happened and then realized what he was. But we don't really get a backstory. This is kind of what I assume is happening. And then James finds his actual file, which has all the information about him. It literally, there's a article like about him as like a kid. It just says growing up in San Francisco, which is so funny because he kept saying that. And his prescription for his medication, his family's death, like in the newspaper, the coupon he used in the Mexican restaurant 2 days earlier, and photos of his wife and child when they were alive. And he's like, how would you have this? He also finds a photo of him sitting naked in a chair, a photo he clearly does not remember taking. And he hears Allison's whispering, where were you? Where were you? And then he hears his son's voice say, on the first night he finds you. On the second night, you see him, sort of in the incantation, and James drives to the hospital.
And we're on
day three. So we're heading towards the end here. So James drives to the hospital, and he tries to pump the nurse at the nurse's station for information. Because at night, she's the only one there. And she's like, look, I can't tell you any information. But he was admitted to Bellevue 23 years ago. He's stable. He's not on life support, but he's unresponsive. 5 years, he was sent to Bellevue, and then 5 years later he was transferred to Stockholm Health. And then he was sent to a private clinic in Cedar Rapids until 2 years ago, and he was brought here. It's like, well, that's quite a bit for someone who can't tell you much at the hospital.
Yeah.
But she says, he's a John Doe. I don't know his name. As far as I know, clearly he's like an important person or he has money in his family or something because he gets a lot of visitors and the bills are always paid, right? So the implication is like the cult is sort of using him
as a vessel,
to get this information. And she says, actually, there's a visitor in there with him now. James looks in the room and we see Amanda sitting on the bed. So Amanda is alive and she's visiting this man. And the nurse turns to James and says, and the nurse kind of like, it's like a little like, she's like seductive. And maybe that's not exactly, I'm like, maybe I'm just reading it that way.
Sure.
But she sort of turns to him and says like, so is he the man you've been looking for? So we sort of understand the nurse also is in on it.
Okay.
Like she has like a,
she says that to James.
So much stuff to James. He goes in and he sees that it is Amanda. And he asks her, well, who is this? What is his name? And she says, I don't know either. He transmits and we receive. Meanwhile, James steps out to call Nora to be like, I found her. I can let you know. You know, like, don't freak out. And Amanda's trimming and shaving the man's beard, like taking care of him like you would of someone who is unconscious, you know, like just tending to him. Allison, when Nora picks up the call and James says, I found Amanda, Nora says, who is this? Allison, Nora has no idea who James is.
What?
He hangs up. And Amanda has to do, this actress has to do a lot of heavy lifting here at the end. And I really, because like she has to lay it all out for us. And I really appreciate everything she's giving.
Somebody has to shoulder this burden. And
yeah. Sasha Frolova, shout out to her. She here we go. Because she's going to try to land this plane, bitch. Okay. Sweet. So he's obviously distraught. And she tells him, basically, we need a new transmitter. A body can only handle this so much power for so long. He's been, you know, we know that he's been like this since 1995.
Right.
Clearly, the cult's been drawing for him. Then we finally flash back to our boy Paul in the cave in case we didn't pick it up, but we get it, right? And she says, there's actually a 500-year gap between this transmitter and the last one. So presumably, the last person who was in that cave, right?
Okay.
And it's like, we don't want to risk going without a transmitter, so we did something risky. We made one. James is freaking out. He's like, you're fucking crazy. This is insane.
Yeah.
But then he also starts to grab his head and he's screaming and he falls to the ground. And she's like, you know, you thought I didn't know about you, my mother, but I knew because I wrote it, James. I wrote it into the script when we created you. And she says, when was your birthday? And he says, it's November 3rd. She's like, no, your birthday, your actual birthday was 3 days ago when we conjured you into being.
Huh?
You are our Tulpa. You are our empty man. And she says to him, what's the worst thing that's ever happened to you? You could say it. And it's obviously the death of his wife and son. And he's like, we could only create you through grief, sorrow, or guilt. But then I was also like, well, yeah, but it's not real, girl. Like, I was like, it's not connected to reality, but I guess maybe it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And she tells James, wouldn't it just be easier to let go? Because if you allow yourself to be emptied out, then you don't have to worry about any of this. Like, it's all gone, and you just become a vessel for this entity that we're communicating with beyond space and time. And we see sort of this flash of James when he was standing on the catwalk on the Institute. We see him look up, and he realizes that he was the empty man coming into the room. Like, he is both seeing himself on the catwalk, and then he himself is emerging as the empty man.
Okay.
And everyone blows their bottles, and James drops his red file. And then he turns and he runs down a hallway and he sees the chair where obviously he was taking photos of him nude. And beyond it, we see the giant shrouded figure. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the skeleton from the cave in Bhutan. It emerges from the wall as if it's the skeleton emerging from the wall, cloaked in a shroud, and chases James through the basement of the Institute.
Okay.
And as he turns, the lights click off after him one by one until the figure lunges out of the darkness. And in this, I think they did a great job of not showing you too much. Because when the figure lunges out, it now has flesh.
Okay.
But you don't see it directly, but what you do see, it has tentacles and sort of like a lamprey eel mouth. And that's when I was like, oh, it's H.P. Lovecraft.
Yes.
It's an elder god. It's something from beyond time made manifest. We just saw its skeleton. It is like this. Yes. It's a monstrous godlike creature. And it holds James' mouth open, and unfortunately, it starts pumping black goo from inside its, like, head cavity into his mouth.
I don't love the goo.
And I guess it's like that's him clearing him out, sort of a black goo enema from beyond space and time, you know. James awakens in the basement of the Institute and runs down the alleyway, still somehow convinced he'll escape. And we see, finally, the full story of, like, the night of his family's death. We see him at the funeral. So it's the night of the of Nora's husband's funeral. So the implication to me is that these two families were friends. Mm-hmm. Nora's husband dies. Mm-hmm. She and James were already having an affair.
Okay.
we see, we also like cut to the grieving families of all the kids who died in the high school, the grieving family of all the kids, the people who died in Bhutan with Paul. And we see James run to his home and he smashes open the door. But of course, when he opens it, there's nobody living there. He doesn't actually live there. It's just a house they put in his mind.
Okay.
And then we see at the end of the hallway, there's light coming from underneath his bedroom door. Mm-hmm. And in his flashback, we see James stay with Nora at the house and send Allison and Henry home, you know, ahead of him in the snow. And as they're driving, a deer darts out in front of him and Allison swerves, sending the car off a bridge, flying to their death. And you do see Nora and James fucking for a second. And I thought it was funny because she's wearing like the sexiest, like thigh high black silk stockings, like matching nightie and bra. It's like, maybe somebody's wearing that to their husband's funeral. I think you're barely getting out the fucking door.
No, I don't think so.
You should be wearing the most comfortable underwear possible so you can get through the fucking day. The idea of like, ooh, I'm going to wear heels. It's like, that is.
Putting on thigh highs to grieve.
Honey, that's a third date, and that's if you're lucky. This is the idea that like she is mourning her husband who died.
Yeah,
and this is what she's wearing. I thought was very funny, and also like how Catholic to be, or like how like Christian to be, like the greatest sin you had sex with this lady. You know, right. It's like there's a God who's vomiting black goo in your mouth
and
like,
making people kill
beat
themselves.
Yourself up about it.
Like
also none of this actually happened. That was my part of the end. I'm like, okay, but like why did you make him go through this? But so finally. James goes to the hospital and he lifts his gun and he shoots the man in the hospital bed. He empties the clip in his head, like fucking blows his brain, blood sprayed everywhere. And the blood sort of forms the shape of the seated man and sort of like the little T on top of his head is just part of the structure of the hospital bed. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, I guess we were leading up to this. Like he was seeing it and
sure.
It was, then he made it manifest, I suppose. Like the idea was put in his head. Anyways, he kills this guy, and he steps out of the hospital room, and it turns out everyone who works there turns and looks to him. They're all also in on it.
Of course.
And we hear a low, of course, across the bottle as everyone who is still there drops their knees to pray to him, and we end with a whisper, you transmit, we receive. The empty man, Allison.
Whoa.
I did want to talk about some questions I had.
I have some as well.
First of all, so does that mean he's now in a coma? Like, is he going to be in a hospital bed?
I would assume. Does he
but also, he's not real. So, the other guy, Paul, I guess,
was
ostensibly
real.
Had to be hollowed. He was real, so he had something inside. But then it's like, so you had to create a tulpa, and you had to get that tulpa grief and pain or whatever just to give you the ability to create him. But that seems mean. I don't think you should. If you just create a tulpa, don't give him a sad backstory where his wife and kid died.
Yeah, why does he have to have like a lot of guilt and shame associated with a terrible event? Like I don't know. I don't fully
especially sexual
get
shame.
It?
I was like, this is very. That's funny. I did really enjoy it in the end, but there are definitely things at the end. I'm like, all right, I'll allow it. Okay.
So he was never real.
He was never real.
But like, was his family real?
That's what I think it was like, is Amanda real?
Well, that's the thing. Like
his family wasn't real. His family wasn't real. The family was not real.
Okay.
But Nora was real because he called Nora.
Right.
So maybe Amanda was real and Nora was real. But he was a tulpa.
But like, yeah, I guess like who's real is like a lingering question that I'll have for this film.
Right. And then it's like, and I think this is the same thing, a question I have about Hereditary. Where we get to the end. If you haven't seen Hereditary, go watch it or don't. Listen to our episode. It's like, so what's the game plan here? Right? It's like, okay, so the cult wins. In this case, like the cult wins.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So
they've got him for a couple hundred years to.
Right.
Or 20. It's like a little unclear.
Right, like, yeah, is a tulpa does it live till 80 again?
Is it like a normal lifespan for a human? And it's like you just get what you get out of him?
And then also it's like, do the cult
members...
And then
you have to make another one?
I guess it's like, are the cult members... Because Garrett said it's going to be a bloodbath. So I'm like, okay, so I guess the cult members are just fine with that. But also, you're still... They're human, so they could be killed or... I don't know. Again, I don't need to know all the answers. But at the end of it, I was like, huh, okay. All right.
Certainly something.
Yeah. What are some fatal mistakes you think were made in the movie The Empty Man, Allison?
mistakes.
I mean, in general, summoning.
Yeah.
Like, when you fell down that crevasse, like, don't touch anything. Don't blow on anything. Don't.
And also, if you're Greg, tell your other two right away.
Yes.
You don't see him say anything. And I would be like, hey, Paul aside, I saw a gigantic, weird skeleton
right.
down there.
It's like, even if it's not something you guys are going to sort through, like, maybe someone else should know about it.
Right. Yeah, just send someone down there just to make sure. I guess it's some sort of elder god that got stuck down there but still exists in the nuosphere. And, you know, it's not for us to figure out, obviously.
No.
But I guess they could have told someone, but of course they didn't make it off the mountain. But also then it's like, well, so who found Paul? Because Paul, I guess maybe Paul just walked down the mountain.
Like, yeah, if he was, right. Like, I guess empty he just kind of like got himself back to somewhere that then they were like, but like when did he go like in
comatose?
Yeah. Like,
yeah.
When was that?
And then, like, you see, like, on the Wikipedia, you see that Arthur Parsons, basically, there's the implication is, like, he was in a cave in Jordan. You know, like, right. that was part of it. But it's, like, did he talk to the empty man, or was this,
right.
like, was Paul lucid for a while, and he met Paul while Paul was still, like, alive and
talking?
And
then, like, turned him into the empty man? But,
right.
like, also,
so it does
he-
mean-
Did that? I don't know.
But that does make me want to read the comic book. Because
yes.
as a, you know, as we said, like, because they do talk about it like, oh, it's communicable. But it's, to me, it was much more of like a cult, like a religious, mm-hmm. like, oh, religious mm-hmm. ideas are the things that are issue. And they we spread. And like, if you believe in it, versus they talk about it more like it's an actual disease or
right.
conceptualizing it as a disease, which I also think is a very interesting way to think of it.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe it's both. Maybe it's just sort of like a way to depict that on screen. And I thought it was good. Again, too long,
so long.
But I did enjoy it.
Yeah. If you do read the comic book, I think we should do like an update.
Absolutely.
So if you end up doing that, because I would be interested to know like what clarity we could find from, you know, another medium for the story, because it is interesting, but I'm still confused.
Also, I wanted to shout out because a couple of people sent us information about the shadow puppets.
Oh, yes.
The shadow puppets from
Candyman.
Boop, boop, boop. Let me try to find it. Here we go. Yeah, a couple people, Serena on Twitter, they give her sending it. And to everyone who sent it, I always want to shout them out. It's
it was
a collaboration with Manual Cinema, a Chicago-based design company who focused on integrating practical theater elements into the silver screen. And they're the ones who worked on the shadow puppetry, which I thought was beautiful. And I think, you know, in LA, they have the Bob Barker Marionette Theater, mm-hmm. which I've never been to. But I really have a healthy respect for puppetry.
Mm-hmm.
And other kinds of arts that I don't know how to do and I don't know much about. So I think it's a good example of like, well, I didn't know a damn thing about it, but I'm really glad that this exists.
Yeah.
And I appreciate everyone sending it to us. And if you have any interest in this kind of art form,
yes.
please look it up. But we just really appreciate that. It was very nice
yeah,
of you to send it to
love
us.
That.
You know we're
thank you.
You know we're dumb as hell,
yep.
so we appreciate
yeah.
it.
Any help we could get, we absolutely need.
absolutely. So yeah, where would you put this movie on the spooky scale, Allison?
A spooky scale.
This feels like a 6 for me. I feel like a 6 feels like a lot of scary stuff, a lot of eeriness. You know, cult stuff is always scary because you're learning rules to something. But I think the confusing elements kind of take away a little bit from the scariness.
You know what? I'm going to go 6 as well.
Yeah, it feels like a real 6.
Yeah, I really
spookiness.
Appreciated all the elements. I do, for me, the two long monologues about the cult, I get it. I get what we had to do. It is a comic book. Like, it is, it is an adaptation. How do you adapt this whole worldview?
Mm-hmm.
I'm very empathetic to that. But yeah, the beginning, fucking dynamite when they're on the mountain, loved it.
Yeah.
Everyone in it is phenomenal. I thought it was beautifully directed. And I loved a lot of, like, very compelling uses of sound, like repetition
yeah.
of sound. And, you know, hey, look, I don't need everything to make total sense.
No.
You know what I mean? And by the end of it, I thought, I'm glad I saw this. So,
great.
So that was it. Well, and thank you for joining us, you guys.
Yes.
And as always, please
keep it spooky. Don't forget to follow us at Ruin Podcast and Crooked Media for show updates. And if you're as opinionated as we are, consider dropping us a review. Ruined is a Radio Point and Crooked Media production. We're your writers and hosts, Hallie Kiefer and Allison Leiby. The show is executive produced by Alex Bach, Sabrina Fonfetter, and Houston Snyder, and recorded and edited by Kat Iosa. From Crooked Media, our executive producer is Kendra James, with production and promotional support from Ari Schwartz, Kyle Sieglin, Julia Beach, Caroline Dunphy, and Awa Okolade.